All right, if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Proverbs chapter 6. So I was raised, mostly, for most of my childhood, I was raised by a single dad. And the thing about my dad is he really likes to be prepared for things. He's very oriented towards what are the things that could go wrong and how can we prevent them from going wrong. So a lot of my childhood was spent like troubleshooting problems that never actually happened, but we were definitely ready for those problems. For example, I grew up in a very small town in Oklahoma. So as a family in rural Oklahoma is wont to do, we had a lot of tornado drills. And so like anytime there was like a rumble in the sky at any time of day, it was like, okay, everybody go to the basement. And it was like, how fast can we get there? Like many nights at 2 a.m. if there was rain, that I would be like violently woken up by my dad, like, get in the basement. And it turned out to be fine. Like our house is still there as far as I know to this day. But we had a lot of tornado drills. And if you are woken up in that way and you have like 15 minutes and then the rain goes away and then my dad is like, okay, well then just go back to bed. You're not going back. Like what? No, you're up. Like that's the day. You're might as well go to school at this point at 2 a.m. So a lot of tornado drills. I remember specifically when I was learning how to drive. My dad, and again, small town in Oklahoma, so there were a lot of like narrow roads. I grew up near Route 66, which is like a lot of accidents happen on Route 66. And so there was a lot of my dad taking me as he was teaching me to drive, taking me to various places like within a 20-mile radius of our house and showing me point by point like how a person died in a car accident at that particular spot. I got a lot of, okay, here, turn here. Okay, you're going to want to turn, make a very slight, oh, yeah, somebody was T-boned and wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And then and now you're going to want to turn over here. A lot of, that's why you always use your turn signal. And because, you know, decapitation could happen at any moment. And like there's... I feel like that's really grim. That was probably a darker joke than everybody was prepared for today. So sorry about that. But I got a lot of cautionary tales, a lot of stories about people who died in vehicular accidents. And I mean, not just that, like motorcycle, bike accidents, just because I wasn't planning to ever like drive a motorcycle, but you never know. And so my dad decided to just cover all of his bases and, you know, like canoe accidents, who knows. But so really prepared for all those eventualities. And I definitely grew up, before I learned how to drive, I had definitely been given talks about, like, that started with phrases along the lines of, okay, if you're ever held at gunpoint, here's what you need to know. Or, if you ever think you're being followed. Or my favorite one, the one that has continued to be burned into my brain was, if you're ever arrested in a foreign country, here's what you need to do. I'd never been to a country outside of the United States until I was like out of high school. But it was good to be aware of like, okay, here's what you do. If you're ever in like Turkey and you end up in a prison cell. Okay, good to know, great. So that was my upbringing. I grew up, and it's not like my dad is afraid of things. I don't see him as a person who is overly like fearful of things, but he's very cautious. And it's not, and again, it's not about fear, it's about preparation. The whole thing is you don't want to be in a situation where something could take you by surprise. And so my dad lives his life in like a crouched and ready stance at all time. And quite frankly, almost nothing has ever surprised him for this reason. Because and I don't know if he's going to listen to this podcast. If he does, I'm deeply grateful for everything. But there was sort of an embedded sense of anything can go wrong, and so you need to be ready for all of it. And so a lot of my sort of early memories are about preparing for the worst. And again, it wasn't just about being cautious, and it wasn't even about being afraid. It was about being prepared. It was, are you ready for the things that might go wrong in your life? And we've been in the series, like, what do you do if you're in the middle of, like, talking and, like, a train goes by and it blows its horn really loud? I wasn't ready for that either. But that didn't land as funny as I thought it might. But we've been in this series where we're talking about patterns. And we've been talking about these invisible patterns that we all internalize, whether we know it or not. And a lot of us, and I would argue all of us at one level or another, are driven by something that we don't always even know is there. That there is some sort of motivating factor that is in us, and we're not always conscious of it, but it is very involved a lot of the time in making our choices and determining what we say, what we don't say, what we think, what we don't think, how we act and think, or how we interact with the rest of the world. And the pattern that we're talking about today is this pattern of looking for security, looking for safety, always being prepared, always like being just cautious enough to not get taken by surprise by something. And so the pattern shows up in all sorts of acts of like caution, awareness of potential risks and dangers at various points in your life, advanced problem solving. Like if you know somebody who's always thinking ahead, or like if you woke up today and you were getting ready to come here and there was somebody else in your house checking the weather on their phone and checking how icy is it on the bridges between here and the church, and you weren't just like, well, whatever, it'll just be slippery, so we'll just go. And like if somebody else in your house was like, no, let's wait, let's do the research first, then you might live with somebody who has this pattern, at least at some level within them. And I would argue probably all of us have this to some degree or another. If you wore a seatbelt to get here today, then you probably, you have a survival mechanism. You have it in you to at least know, at a certain level to be prepared and to be cautious. If you've vaccinated your kids, if you have batteries in your smoke detectors, there are certain things. If you know what to do if you're ever arrested in a foreign country, there are certain things that you just know to do because we all have sort of a certain amount of self-preservation locked in. But some of us are a lot more tuned into that than others, and some of us this is the core motivation. We don't deal with anything until we know that everybody is okay, and we know that if an eventual crisis happens, we will be prepared for that crisis, and. As with every pattern in the series, this is not a bad pattern and it's not a good pattern, it just is. It just is part of us. And so what we're trying to do with the series is ask the question, not how do we get rid of it, but how do we, knowing that this is part of us, how do we channel this towards something good and healthy? So take a look at Proverbs chapter 6. So first of all, we have to understand, again, this is, at its core, this is a good thing. It can be a very good thing. So in Proverbs 6, we looked at the book of Proverbs last week, by the way, and we talked about how the book of Proverbs is a book all about sort of the celebration of the virtue of wisdom. The book of Proverbs highlights wisdom as the great virtue. And one of the highlights of this virtue, one of the symbols of wisdom, or one of the signals of wisdom, is are you prepared for eventual trouble? So in Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, it says, go to the ant, you sluggard. And sluggard is just, it's not a word we use a lot now, but it's basically a word that means a lazy person who doesn't think ahead. And so this is not unlike the parable of the ant and the grasshopper, but this one says sluggard, whatever. So it says, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? So now he's just name calling. So how long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief and scarcity like an armed man. So in this notion of what does it mean to be wise, there is built in this assumption that part of being wise is being aware that not every day is going to be as easy as today. And the idea that there will come a day, there may be enough food today, but what if there's not enough food tomorrow? And so there's a certain amount of, we have to be prepared, we have to save up, we have to plan for a time of, if now is a time of plenty, what if there's a time where we are not in a time of plenty? And so, There is this notion that to be wise is to be aware that there are seasons in life, and some seasons are better and easier than others, and we need to be at some level prepared for a season when things aren't going to be easy. If you have a savings account, this is where that comes from, right? The idea that, yeah, we're doing okay, so what happens on the day when we stop feeling like we're doing okay? What happens when I lose my job? What happens when we get a bad diagnosis? Are we ready for the day when one of the kids moves out of the house and starts making decisions that we would not have them make? And so there is a certain amount of, are we ready emotionally, physically, financially, whatever, are we ready for the eventuality of sometime something bad might happen or something challenging might happen? Can we deal with that? So there's a certain amount of wisdom that is built into that. And then that gets re-highlighted in Proverbs 22, verse 3, where the writer says, the prudent or the wise see danger and take refuge, but the simple, which seems kind of mean, but whatever, but the simple keep going and pay the penalty. In other words, there are some people who have no sense of caution, no sense of self-preservation. Like, I don't know if you have a five-year-old like I do, but you're like, why would you do that? That I told you that was hot five times. Why did you touch it? I don't know. Some people, it seems like you have to sort of teach people sometimes a sense of self-preservation. Some people have it though. Some people just have a natural sense of, okay, maybe don't touch the very, 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 very hot surface that someone just told me not to touch. And what the writer of Proverbs continues to articulate is there is a certain amount of wisdom in knowing where trouble might be coming, and how to either avoid or minimize the damage that will come when this happens. And so this is built up as a virtue, this whole notion of this is good, like the ability to think ahead. Like teaching your kid to drive by letting him know that he's not invincible is not a terrible idea. And having, like, living in a small town in Oklahoma where tornadoes are like part of life, like reminding kids to get in the basement at 2 a.m., not a bad idea. I mean, it doesn't like go well at school the next day, but it's not the worst possible idea. So there is a certain amount of caution, planning ahead. These things are good. These things are necessary. Again, this is why you wore a seatbelt today. We all have this. And people who have this pattern are, by the way, ready for a crisis. If you know somebody who has this pattern, who is like really dialed into this, there's an assumption about people who have this pattern that they may, like, if there's a crisis, that they're just going to like collapse because they're constantly afraid that something bad's going to happen. And so when something does happen, they just can't handle it. That is absolutely the opposite of what's actually real. What a person like this, a person who is always thinking about like the eventual problems and is always sort of working through like, are we prepared? If something terrible does happen, that's the person who becomes laser focused. And is like, when everybody else is freaking out, this is the person who says, okay, I'm ready for this. And the reason they're ready for this is because they've already lived through it a dozen times and now it's finally happening. And so there is a certain amount of, like a person who thinks like this is the person you want with you when crisis comes, because this is the person who's ready to start working out solutions because they've already thought through all the different ways to solve the problems. Another virtue that kind of comes along with this is people who have this pattern tend to be very loyal because along with this comes a certain sense of suspicion and a certain sense of a lack of trust for things that they don't have a certain amount of familiarity with. But the positive side of that is if you are a person who has earned this person's trust, then you will always, there is a certain amount of loyalty that like something awful would have to happen for this person to stop being loyal to you or to an organization or an institution, because once you've been allowed inside the circle, it gets very difficult to go out. Because what we're looking for, what this person, a person with this pattern is looking for, is security and stability. And if something is inside the circle, then that thing is deemed safe and stable. And so it takes a lot for something to get moved out, back out of the circle once it's been let in. So like, for example, if you know somebody who has this pattern and they have a favorite restaurant and they've been going to this restaurant for like 30 years, but the last like 10 times they've gone there, they got food poisoning. And you say to them, you know, you don't have to go to this restaurant. They would say, yeah, but you know, we've been going there for so long and it's been really rough for the restaurant industry, and they'll get it together. And like, as long as you stay hydrated, food poisoning's not that bad. And they've been going through a slump. We just need to be patient. And I have my favorite booth, and I may or may not be describing somebody that I know who raised me. And so there is this sense of almost blind loyalty when a person who has this pattern decides to trust a person or an institution. It takes a lot for that trust to be broken, which is a virtue, right? Like and every one of us could say, like, I wouldn't mind more people who are loyal and trusting in my life. And so these are good qualities. This is something that the writer of Proverbs highlights. But again, like all these patterns, there's a dark side. So the virtue here is people are ready for a crisis. People are loyal. People are considered wise by the standards of the book of Proverbs. But the darker side is, yeah, but what happens when this like descends into fear, like deep-seated like fear and anxiety and paranoia? What happens when the emotion of fear begins to write the script for us? So take a look at Luke chapter 19. In Luke 19, Jesus tells a parable, and this is a weird parable. It's not unique in that way. There's a lot of weird parables, but this is one, I think it gets kind of edited for us because there's a part of this parable you've heard, and I would probably imagine there's a part of it that's maybe been like glided over because we don't know what to do with it. So take a look at, we'll just look at all of it and we'll see what we can do with it. So in Luke chapter 19, verse 11, it says, while they were listening to this, he, Jesus, went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. He said, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return, which is already a scenario that we have no familiarity with. Already we're way outside of what we understand as normal. So we'll come back to that. So then it says, so he, this guy who's going to another country to be made king for some reason. So it says, so he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. And if you have a footnote in your Bible, it should say that a mina is about 3 months' wages. So he's giving out about 30 months' wages to his servants. And it says, put this money to work, he said, until I come back. But his subjects hated him. Again, what? So his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king, which is, again, it's an unusual thing to have in this parable, but whatever. So and then in verse 15, it says, he was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for his servants, for the servants to whom he had given the money, in order to find out what he had gained with, what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, sir, your mina has earned 10 more. Well done, my good servant, his master replied, because you have been trustworthy in a very small matter. Take charge of 10 cities. The second came and said, sir, your mina has earned 5 more. His master answered, you take charge of 5 cities. Then another servant came and said, sir, here is your mina. I have kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow. So by the way, if you're afraid of somebody because they're really mean and they have a lot of power, maybe don't tell them, you know, because you steal from people. Like that's because that's basically, you know, you take out what you don't put in, you reap what you don't sow. Like, you know, you take credit for other people's work. That's why I'm afraid of you. So and it says, his master replied, I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow. So he totally owns it. Then it says, why then did you put my money on deposit so that when I came back, I could have collected it with interest? Then he said to those standing by, take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. Sir, they replied, he already has 10. In verse 26, he replied, to which they're like, hey, that guy already has a lot. So why are we giving the guy who has a lot even more? And then the king says, I tell you that to everyone who has more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away. By the way, does this sound at all like Jesus? Like the whole idea here, essentially he has this king saying, so people who have a lot will continue to get a lot and people who have nothing will continue to get nothing. That sounds absolutely like foreign to anything that Jesus has ever said anywhere. So this is really weird because, okay, let me finish the parable because it just, okay, verse 27, this is the perfect ending to this. It says, but those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me. Okay, so we tend to, when we read a parable that Jesus tells, we tend to assume if there's a king or a landowner or a father, we assume that whatever the most powerful masculine figure in the story is, we assume that that is God in Jesus' story. But if this is Jesus' version of God, it totally does not match any other version of God that Jesus has given us up to this point. So now we've got us a problem. Because what do we do with a story about a king who acts like this? And again, there's this whole weird side story about how he had to go and be made king in another country. And again, we're like, what is going on here? And he has people killed in front of him for fun. And it's a weird story. So here's what's going on. The people who were first hearing this story would absolutely have been immediately dialed into what's going on here. At this time, the entire territory where they were, the region of the world right now that they're in is called Judea. And Judea had been conquered by the Roman Empire. And when the Roman Empire conquers your territory, one of the things they do to establish order is they appoint somebody who lives there as king. And because Caesar can't be everywhere at once, and so one of the deals is Caesar will let you be king and you can rule over the people in any way you see fit as long as you keep the peace and make sure nobody gets out of line. And so when Rome takes over in Judea, there's a guy named Herod the Great, I think he gave himself that name, who went to Rome to ask Caesar to make him king. And so that happened. And so now Herod the Great became king and became one of the wealthiest men in the world. Then when Herod the Great died, his son Archelaus also had to go to Rome to beg Caesar to make him king. He had to go and kiss the ring, basically, because when there's someone with power and you want him to give you power, the ring is the thing that you kiss. And it was a joke, sorry. So the ring is not the thing you kiss. So what you do is you have to go to Caesar and you have to beg Caesar to let you be king. But because Archelaus was so disliked, there was a group of people who like followed him to Rome who protested outside of Caesar's palace, not the casino, like the real thing. who protested outside the area and were saying, we do not want Archelaus to be our king. But they made Archelaus king anyway because Archelaus is known to be a cruel, harsh ruler. So what do you think happened to the group of people who were like, oh, just kidding, by the way, about that whole thing about not wanting you to be king. You're the best. So So now Archelaus is king, and he comes back, and he begins to rule really, really harshly over the people. And that's who was in charge when Jesus tells this story. So when Jesus is telling the story, he's not saying God is like this king. What he's saying is this king is Archelaus, and nobody likes Archelaus very much. And he's highlighting kind of what's wrong with how Archelaus rules over the people. And so now, tucked inside of this story, you have a story about three guys who have been given a certain amount of money, and they've been told, go put the money to work. And there's one guy who says, I can't do it because I'm terrified. And he has really good reason to be terrified, because Archelaus is crazy. And so he's really worried that what if I do something? What if I step out into, like, what if I make a bad investment? What if I lose Archelaus' money? And so he does nothing. And so this guy is kind of pinned into a terrible situation where he has to either make a choice that could get him into trouble, or he has to make no choice, which ultimately gets him into trouble. So what does this have to do with anything that Jesus is trying to do and trying to say? Because again, I thought the whole point of Jesus' parables was to tell us what God was like or what the kingdom of God was like. Here's what I would argue Jesus is trying to do, because this parable is tucked inside of a chapter about it with a bunch of different, or inside of a book, Luke, filled with other parables talking about the graciousness and generosity of God. So if you tell this story inside of a group of other stories, this is a contrasting story. I would argue that what Jesus is doing here is he is saying, we tend to assume that God is like Archelaus. We tend to assume that God is trying to trick you, and that if you don't do certain things, that God will be really angry and will punish you. But Jesus is saying, that is not what God is like. God is not out to trick you. God is not out to hurt you. God is for you. This parable is sitting in contrast to all the other things that Jesus has been saying and doing, which is God is on your side. This is a story about somebody who is afraid to make any sort of move in his own life because all the powers are pitted against him. And what Jesus is saying is you don't have to be afraid because all the power is not pitted against you. You can live your life. You can engage the world around you because God is on your side. This is a beautiful word of hope in a world where people were afraid and paranoid all the time, because who knows what's going to happen if Archelaus gets mad at you next. So this is not a story about you should be afraid because this guy's out to get you. This is a story of go and live your life. Go and make choices. Engage the world around you. One of the things that happens when fear and paranoia and anxiety have like control over our lives is we make no choices. We don't live in our own lives because we're afraid, like the whole thing is pitted against us. The whole deck is rigged against us. And so what good is it to do anything when we're only going to lose and when we're only going to get in more trouble? And Jesus's message here says, is I would argue saying, no, you go live your life. You have been empowered. You have life. So now go and live it. Go and like step into the world around you. Make choices. Engage in ways that require a little bit of courage, because sometimes that's what life is. So one of the reasons why this pattern can take such a negative hold on us is because it can paralyze us. It can make us totally afraid of even living our lives at all. And so there's another element to this. We talked about the loyalty element earlier, which is a really good thing at its best. But one of the reasons that people with this pattern can be so loyal at the darker side of it is if you can trust someone or something else, you don't need to trust yourself. One of the problems with this guy in the story is he doesn't trust himself. The other two guys did. This guy has no trust in himself at all. He's worried that no matter what he does, it's going to be the wrong choice. And so one of the driving factors when we sort of struggle with this pattern is we don't trust ourselves. And we feel like whatever we do is gonna be wrong, we're just gonna make things worse. And so we make no decisions at all. So what happens if you take this notion of, I can't trust myself, but I also have a great capacity for loyal and trust in somebody else who has a lot of power, what do we do with that? So take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 8. I think this is a bit of a side road, but I think this story is really instructive to what we're kind of talking about. So in the book of 1 Samuel, this is really early in the life of the people of Israel. And what's going on here, up until this point, there has been no king in Israel. Israel has been governed mostly by a group of people called the judges. And so you have not like one major ruler, but you have a group of people who are sort of ruling on behalf of God, basically, in the stories. And so at a certain point, there's a guy named Samuel who at this moment is the judge, who's the primary judge over the people. And the people come to him, and they're concerned about what's going to happen when he's gone. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4, it says, so the elders of Israel gathered together and called Samuel, or came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you are old, which diplomacy is not like the greatest strength of most of the people we find in the Bible, I find. But it says, so they come to him and they say, you are old and your sons do not follow in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, listen to all the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from this day, as they have done from the day I brought them up to Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know that when the king, what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. In other words, this is articulating something that everybody in the known world would have understood already, which is having a king in the ancient Near East is terrible. Nobody should want a king. This is a horrible idea. And he's gonna do a really good job of articulating why. So in verse 10 it says, Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, this is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. In other words, if there's a military conflict, your kids will be the first ones to die. And then in verse 12, it says, some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. In other words, if we put a king in charge, what's going to happen is all the energy and effort and everything that we do will get channeled towards making the king stronger and making the king more powerful and more wealthy. That will be the job of the whole nation, will be to build up the wealth and status of the king and his descendants. That will be our whole job. And so he puts it out there as a pretty good case. And then in verse 18, it says, when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. In other words, let's just take a minute and think about what we're asking for. And so then in verse 19, it says, but the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and what? Fight our battles. So Samuel is saying, look, what you're asking for is terrible. This person is going to take way more than he is going to give you. This person is going to hurt you in all kinds of ways. He's going to make your life much, much harder at every measurable level. But their answer is, that's fine as long as somebody else can fight our battles for us. What they're asking for is, we are fine with a harder, harsher, smaller life as long as we don't have to fight our own battles. So, this is what happens when we become so risk averse and we become so afraid of engaging life at any sort of meaningful, like fulfilling kind of level. We go looking for somebody else to fight our battles for us. This is why, by the way, if you look at certain groups and systems, in a lot of ways, if you know somebody who's a part of like a really restrictive community, or like when I was in college, I did a study on small religious groups that had been born out of the last couple of centuries in the United States, and what groups that we would refer to as cults. And one of the things that the studies continue to find over and over again is when a new cult starts, you can measure its ability to succeed by how harsh the rules are. And the harsher the rules and the more strict the system, the faster the cult will grow. And so what does that tell you? That tells you, like, when people go looking to join something, a lot of the times what they're looking for is they're looking for some sort of closed system that will tell them everything they will, like, what are the rules? What time do I need to get up in the morning? What time do I need to eat? What time should I pray? What time should I go to sleep? How should I raise my kids? How should I make all the decisions? How should I fight my battles? Because what happens when we begin to lack any sort of confidence in ourselves? What happens when we become so risk averse that we cannot engage our own lives? We go looking for another system to live our lives for us. So this kind of pattern can lead to people really sinking really deeply into certain types of traditionalism or even fundamentalism. Any sort of closed system that tells you, if you don't fit into this mold, then you're out. You do not belong here if you don't fit this system. What is that? That is somebody saying, I do not trust myself to come to my own conclusions. So somebody else has to build some parameters around me because I can't fight my own battles. I cannot engage my own life. When this pattern is unhealthy, you might find people who struggle with a lack of any sort of action, a sort of a paralysis in their own life. You might find people hiding behind someone or something else, some larger entity, some larger structure, even if it's a structure that ultimately is not good for them. You might find people who are deferring their role in their own story, people who are taking a pass on their own lives. It can lead to prolonged states of anxiety, which can create lots of physical problems health-wise. It can lead to a general mistrust of everything that's not already on the inside. Anything that isn't already sort of pre-approved, we find that we don't trust it or we just won't let it in. Anything that hasn't been labeled as safe and fun for the whole family doesn't get in. Are you with me? So, just saying, for example. So a lot of times we give up our ability to make our own decisions and to discern our own choices and to basically like live our own lives because we need a system to do that for us. And I think what Jesus is saying with this story, with the guy and the minas, I think he's saying, you don't have to live like that. That God is not like trying to trick you. This is the whole story is inviting you to participate in it. And you don't have to like live out of a sense of fear and anxiety that anything could go wrong at any time. I mean, yeah, be prepared, be aware, but also live your life. Be alive as you're living your life. And when this pattern is healthy, it leads to things like, you know, active troubleshooting and ensuring the well-being of your families and communities. Having a savings account, being able to send your kids to college, having enough gas in your car, making sure like basic structural things are in place. Like these are good, wise things to do. But when we go all the way deep into the dark side of it, it becomes like I'm paralyzed and I can't even live my own life because I don't trust myself. And so somebody else is gonna have to go fight my battles for me. Look at what this writer Paul says in Philippians chapter 4. In Philippians 4, Paul writes, beginning in verse 4, he says, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Now this word rejoice, a lot of times gets read as be pretend happy all the time, and that's not at all what this word actually means. The word rejoice in Greek is the same root word, it's the word charis, it's the same word where we get the word grace. And grace is not like pretend everything is fine. Grace is acknowledge that all of life is a gift. And the action of rejoicing is not like pretend everything is okay. The action of rejoicing is don't let fear pull you out of your own life. Do not let fear write the script for you. And then he goes on and says, let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. How many of us, we are governed by an overwhelming sense of dread and anxiety and fear of the unknown? And how many of us, the good news of this for us is, there is a peace that passes understanding. There is grace for you, that God is for you. The good news of this is, you don't have to let fear write the script for you. There's a book by Elizabeth Gilbert, and the book is called Big Magic. And the book is mostly about creativity and like the process of like creating things. And if you are somebody who loves to create, I recommend this book for that reason. But there's a passage in this book where she specifically deals with the fear that people deal with when they're trying to create something new. And so she uses the word creativity a lot in this, but you could take the word creativity and you could just use it as a substitute for anything that means like live your life, like be fully engaged in your own life. So she decides in this book to write a letter to fear, to her own fear. And so I'm gonna read you Elizabeth Gilbert's letter to her own fear. So she writes, dearest fear, creativity and I are about to go on a road trip together. I understand you'll be joining us because you always do. I acknowledge that you believe you have an important job to do in my life and that you take your job seriously. Apparently, your job is to induce complete panic whenever I'm about to do anything interesting. And may I say, you are superb at your job. So by all means, keep doing your job if you feel you must. But I will also be doing my job on this road trip, which is to work hard and to stay focused. And creativity will be doing its job, which is to remain stimulating and inspiring. There's plenty of room in this vehicle for all of us, so make yourself at home. But understand this, creativity and I are the only ones who will be making any decisions along the way. I recognize and respect that you are part of this family, so I will never exclude you from our activities. But still, Your suggestions will never be followed. You are allowed to have a seat, and you are allowed to have a voice, but you are not allowed to have a vote. You are not allowed to touch the roadmaps. You are not allowed to suggest detours. You are not allowed to fiddle with the temperature. Dude, you're not even allowed to touch the radio. But above all else, my dear old familiar friend, you are absolutely forbidden to drive. How many of us fear has been driving? For how many of us fear has been writing the script? And by the way, when fear writes the script, there's only one line in the script, and the line is no. How many of us, we need to give ourselves permission to re-engage with our lives because the fear, the anxiety, the overwhelming sense of what if this happens has been controlling us for far too long. And this is not to say don't be cautious and don't be aware and don't think ahead. That's wise. What isn't wise, what is deadening, is to pull ourselves out of our own lives and to ask somebody else to fight our battles for us. That is not life. That is something else. So a couple of practices. If this is you, if this is where you find yourself, maybe a couple of practices that will be helpful, hopefully. One is acknowledge what you cannot control. There are certain things in your life that you have no control over. There are certain things in life that you cannot and will never have control over. Find out what those things are and surrender them. Most of the things are actually things that you don't have any control over. You could not control whether or not it was going to rain today, but you came out of your house anyway. You cannot control whether or not someone will forgive you. You cannot, as your kids get older, you will have less and less and less ability to control the choices that they make. You have, except for the kids that are in the room, your parents will always control you. But I saw that. But there are certain things that you cannot control. And so an attempt to try and control, or an anxiety over, like, why can't I control this? All that is a waste of energy. All you're doing is letting fear drive. That's going to deaden your ability to actually interact with the things that you do have some amount of control over. So what are the things that you cannot control? And what does it mean for you just to loosen your grip on those things because you didn't have any control over them anyway? How can you surrender those things? So that's the first thing. The second practice, and this has been huge for me. This has been this has been my favorite practice on dealing with anxiety. And this is to practice present tense mindfulness. And what I mean by that is in moments when I feel really anxious or really overwhelmed, do you ever feel anxious and you don't even know why? You know what I mean? Like you're in the middle of like eating lunch and all of a sudden you feel like you're being chased through the woods by a tiger. And like, what is going on right now? Like what's going on in my brain that's telling me that I should be afraid or anxious right now? So here's a thing that's helped me a lot has been to, in those moments, it's a mantra. I could not even tell you where this first originated, but, and the mantra is to ask yourself the question, what in this moment is lacking? Which is to say, yeah, there are things that will always need my attention. There are things that will always be a little bit shaky and that will always require a little bit of concern. But in this moment, at this time, is there anything that is an immediate emergency that needs my attention? And we're all sitting here pretty calmly right now, so I'm guessing the answer is no. So at least at this very moment. Because one of the things that anxiety does is it pulls us out of the present and it leaves us in the future. And so the role here is, yeah, be aware of what may or may not happen down the road, but also be aware that your life is happening right now as it's happening. Like as the minutes tick by, that is your life. And so your job is to be alive in your own life right now. So part of that is to kind of center yourself and to kind of bring yourself back to the present. Maybe, again, just a thing that's helped me to ask, okay, what in this moment is lacking? Like, okay, right now, there are lots of things that I might have to worry about later. But right now at this moment, all I have to do is finish preaching this sermon. And that is literally like my life right now. So what in this moment for you is lacking? And if you're not like bleeding from the head, or if someone isn't like putting a padlock on your front door while you're sitting here, then you're probably, like for the most part, we're probably mostly okay right now. So the question becomes, okay, what are the things that I'll have to deal with later? But right now, at this moment, what is lacking? What am I missing? What is hurting right now? And a lot of times the answer is nothing. All it is like me working out scenarios in my head about something that I will have to deal with later. And I'm not saying don't deal with those things, but if you're trying to remind yourself that you're alive right now in this moment, that's a helpful thing to do. So that's one. And then the last practice is give yourself permission to trust. And when I say trust, I mean, first of all, trust yourself to make choices in your own life. Like ask people for help, ask people for advice, but give yourself permission to not freeze up and to not retreat out of your own life. You have a life and you can live it. So trust yourself that you you have a certain amount of wisdom and decision-making capacity. Trust yourself to do that. Also, maybe trust people who are outside of the circle. Because one of the things that happens, again, is we go looking for a closed system, because the impulse is to go looking for stability and security. And a lot of times it's anybody who's on the inside is safe, and anybody who's not on the inside isn't safe. But here's the problem with that. Sometimes there are lots of things that we don't know that are outside our bubble or our fenced area. And so one of the challenges of life is to go looking outside of the thing that we already understand and are familiar with. And yeah, that's gonna come with some risk. And yeah, sometimes it may not go the way that we hope it will, but sometimes we may discover something we never would have discovered if we'd stayed locked up where we were. So what does it mean for you to give yourself permission to go looking in new spaces for new things to maybe allow yourself to trust? How many of us were looking for a peace that passes understanding? And a lot of times when we don't trust, or when we live our lives just constantly working out problems in the future, or when we try and control things that we can't control, that is not peace, that is something else. And when Paul writes to this group of people, he says, no, live your life as if fear doesn't have the last word, and live your life as if there is a greater peace that you have access to. Live your life as if God is on your side. So may you live your life. May you receive peace that is past understanding. And may you absolutely refuse to let fear drive. Let me pray for us. God, we thank you for the invitation to have courage in our own lives. And for those of us, first of all, for those of us who have this pattern, thank you for the gift that is this pattern. Thank you for the ability to see problems and to create stable systems and security. Thank you for the capacity that we have for self-preservation. Thank you that we care enough about the people in our lives to make sure that they're safe as well. And for those of us who have been locked into fear and anxiety, may we be set free from that. May we no longer go looking for someone else to fight our battles. May we no longer let fear drive. Give us strength, give us confidence, give us the ability to trust, and help us to experience our lives as they are happening. May we be fully present as we engage the lives that we have. And may we take the risks that we need to take. May we show moral courage when it is required. May we be free from all the ways that we are being held back by the emotion of fear. And may we receive a peace that passes understanding. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.